What the debt limit is and isn't all kind of depends on how you think about money. A special program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 22nd of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So we have reached, it seems, the dueling press conferences stage of the debt limit negotiations. There's a meeting at the White House, after which President Biden makes some remarks, then Speaker McCarthy speaks, or maybe the order goes the other way. But either way, that's about as far as things seem to have gotten. So we are not going to talk about the meeting at the White House today, or who said what, or where things stand. What we are going to do over the next half an hour is offer a whole nother way to think about this whole thing. Back in March, just a day or two after she'd gotten back from that surprise visit to Kyiv, I went to Washington to see Janet Yellen.
Morning, Madam Secretary. How are you?
Good morning. Long time no see.
Long time no see.
Nice to see.
We talked about Ukraine and China and the labor market and inflation, and then this.
I have to ask you about the debt limit. Do you think that the way we treat our obligations in this country and the political ping pong ball that they become, do you suppose that makes us look unserious to the rest of the world?
Well, I think the rest of the world does become concerned when they see members of Congress threatening to prevent the United States from paying its bills.
That's pretty much the company line, right? You'd expect nothing less, because by that point, back in March, we'd already hit the debt limit, $31.4 trillion, if you're keeping track. House Republicans had already made it clear they were going to leverage the debt limit for budget cuts. Yellen had already started using those extraordinary measures you've heard about, and she'd already sent a letter to Congress asking them, imploring them, really, to protect the full faith and credit of the United States. And yet, here we are. I've been covering the debt ceiling for years now. And every time it comes up, we do the same stories over and over and over again. This time, though, we're going to do something different. Something very different. A kind of a fundamental concept about this economy that we've never really talked about. So, on the program today, a businessman. You are one of the voices of wisdom for us, all right?
I'll do my best.
A political scientist.
Okay, we're running.
And a legal theorist. Hey, it's Kai Rizdal in Los Angeles. How are you?
Good, thank you. I just pressed the recording button.
Let's remember the subject at hand here, shall we? How much the Treasury Secretary can borrow, how many Treasury bills and bonds and notes she can sell to pay the bills that Congress has already run up. Or, if you think about it another way, before we get into the nuts and bolts of this thing, clearly this is a discussion about the nature of money.
Yes, that's right.
Like I said, we're going to talk about a kind of fundamental concept in this economy, how money works. Rowan Gray is our legal theorist. He's an assistant professor of law at Willamette University, where he studies the legal design of money and finance.
You cannot borrow something that doesn't already exist. So where did it come from? That's the part of the story that our traditional textbooks, our traditional media does not start with. It's sort of like in the beginning, there was the world. Well, where did it come from? You know, in the beginning, there was money and we borrowed it. Well, where did it come from? It didn't just emerge out of the ground bubbling up in, you know, swamp vats or something. It got created. And so what we are talking about here is the debt ceiling is not a ceiling on borrowing. It's a ceiling on creating a certain kind of money.
All right, stop. I'm going to play that bit again.
The debt ceiling is not a ceiling on borrowing. It's a ceiling on creating a certain kind of money.
Picture a $10 bill for me. It's just a piece of paper worth $10 because everybody trusts that you can trade it for 10 $1 bills or $10 worth of goods and services. U.S. Treasuries, those bills and bonds and notes that Janet Yellen sells, they're the same IOUs from the federal government that we just believe in.
What government debt is a special form of money that has special properties. It is high denomination. It's high value. So if you're an average person living your life buying milk, you're not buying milk with government debt. But if you're a large investor, you are holding government debt as a form of money or a safe asset. If you're at Goldman Sachs, you're holding 3-month treasury bills as money.
Investors all over the world store those treasuries in their bank accounts or trade them with other investors because they believe in them, just like cash.
The normal way we think of issuing debt is like borrowing. That is to say, you don't have something, you need to go find someone who has it and convince them to give it to you. But the reality is the government creates money. So it isn't borrowing something from somebody else. It's creating the thing that it actually then issues out.
That's what we're talking about when we talk about the debt limit. Not about how much money the government can borrow or spend, but how much money the government can create.
The debt ceiling is not a ceiling on borrowing, it's a ceiling on creating a certain kind of money. And when you have a cap on one kind of money, but you have a legal commitment to spend other money into existence, you look at the other options available.
Told you this was going to be a different kind of story about the debt limit, didn't I? All right, so let's talk about those other options that Rowan Gray mentioned. One of them in particular. If you look at the Treasury Department's organizational chart, you'll see there's a whole agency in the business of literally creating money.
There are so many myths that have been built around money.
Philip Deal is the businessman in this story. Back in the 1990s, he was the director of the U.S. Mint.
It's a Fortune 500 size agency, if it were a private enterprise. It has multiple lines of business. One is circulating coins, and that's what everybody thinks of about the Mint, of course. Nickels, dimes, quarters, pennies.
That's the Mint's first line of business.
Also, it produces bullion coins, which are sold into international markets as a way of investing in precious metals.
That is business line number two.
And then there are commemorative or collectible coins that are sold to collectors. And also there's a police function, and that includes guarding the gold at Fort Knox.
Apologies for the layperson question here, but I got a couple of nuts and bolts things. How does the Mint make money?
Well, there's a concept called seigniorage.
That's S-E-I-G-N-I-O-R-A-G-E, seigniorage.
And that's the difference in the cost of producing a coin and the face value of the coin.
For instance?
In my day, when there was about a 5-cent margin on the quarter, so we sold it to the Fed and then made that profit, and that profit went to the general fund of the Treasury.
Hold that thought in your mind, because when Deal was running the Mint, he helped write a law that unintentionally and in theory could help solve the debt limit problem. All right, so I want to talk to you now about the piece of legislation in question that's at the heart of this debate. It is, as I'm sure you have memorized now, and it will be the first line of your obituary in the New York Times, 31 U.S.C. Section 5112.
Yes.
Here you go.
The secretary may mint and issue platinum bullion coins and proof platinum coins in accordance with such specifications, designs, varieties, quantities, denominations, and inscriptions as the secretary, in the secretary's discretion, may prescribe from time to time. 37 words.
How many words?
37 words.
Those 37 words, when they became law in 1997, gave the Treasury Secretary the authority to make platinum coins, got to be platinum, of any value as the Secretary may prescribe. The wording was intentionally broad.
I want to go out and do market research and then design a coin based on that research.
But what Philip Deal and the lawmakers who supported that legislation didn't quite realize at the time is that those 37 words created a big, giant loophole in the debt limit.
they'd simply write $1 trillion on the coin. That would be what was inscribed. Then they'd ship it off to the Federal Reserve.
What was your, the first time you read about it, what was your gut reaction?
Wow. Genius.
We'll be right back. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. On the face of it, we were talking a minute ago about the debt limit, a ceiling, if you will, on how much money the Treasury Secretary can borrow to pay the bills that Congress has already run up. But really, what we were talking about is how money works.
They'd simply write $1 trillion on the coin. That would be what was inscribed. Then they'd ship it off to the Federal Reserve.
Philip Deal used to run the U.S. Mint. He's the guy who helped get those 37 words written into law, giving the Treasury Secretary the authority to mint platinum coins of any value. Rowan Gray is the lawyer who spent the better part of a decade now taking those 37 words and making the legal argument for avoiding default with a high-value coin.
And it was originally designed to help the mint make what they call seigniorage revenue, which is the difference between the face value and the cost of selling it.
A very high-value coin.
There's no limit on the denomination. You could make it $100, $1,000, $1 million, and as we have said, to kind of make the point in a big splashy way, $1 trillion.
To be clear, it does not need to be $1 trillion worth of platinum. It just needs to be a coin the size of a quarter or a silver dollar, whatever, that says $1 trillion on it.
That's right. You don't even need to write all the zeros. You can just put a T there and we know what we mean, right? So yes, the whole point is we have severed the link decades ago between the amount of metal and the coin. Now, there are people out there that say, we think it should be a big one just for the sort of symbolic purposes. And I like that idea. So my suggestion was, let's have a big paper mache coin. And then we roll it down the street, you know, 10 feet high. And then we beat it with a stick like a piñata. And all these little silver gold coin, chocolate coins come out. And there's one real platinum coin in there.
Kidding, but not kidding. Mint the coin, take it over to the Federal Reserve, and just like that, the debt limit doesn't matter anymore. It's a real idea that serious people take seriously.
My argument is that given the choice between default and minting the coin, the executive branch does not have the right to default. They cannot choose default over looking silly. If they think this is silly, if they think this is, you know, going to make public raise their eyebrows at them, well, sorry. You know, you should have fixed this when you had the chance.
You've become one of a handful of people who are the go-to people about this. And I just wonder what took an unassuming law professor into this area. What was it about this that got you all fired up? Because clearly you are.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So actually, I was a law student at the time. It was 2011. I had just moved to the United States a year before, 2 years before. I came to the United States right at the start of President Obama's presidency.
Good evening. Tonight, I want to talk about the debate we've been having in Washington over the national debt. A debate that directly affects...
And I watched him stand up and say, we're running out of money.
If that happens and we default, we would not have enough money to pay all of our bills. Bills that include monthly Social Security checks, veterans benefits, and the government contracts.
Now, I wasn't a PhD economist, but I knew even at that point that the government creates money. The idea that we've run out doesn't make any sense. There's a big infinity sign next to the amount of money the government has. Does that mean the government can and should spend infinity? No. But it means when you say things like, we don't have any money, you're not actually telling the truth.
We should be clear here that what was happening then is what's happening now. Republicans in the House holding the debt limit hostage for policy gains.
And we got to this point where a lawyer who was on the blogs that I was reading, the economics blogs, said, well, I found this provision of the Coinage Act.
Those 37 words, the secretary may mint and issue platinum bullion coins and proof platinum coins in the secretary's discretion.
That seems to suggest that we can get through this without this sort of huge fiscal cliff debate. And I looked at it and I said, wow, I think he's right.
Other people did too.
And then I saw it go from these obscure blogs all the way to the front page of the newspaper. And it got to The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
John Stewart, our guest tonight, Mr. John.
And Paul Krugman is arguing with John Stewart, and John Stewart saying, "Well, I'm just a clown, you know, I'm just a silly man, but this seems crazy to me."
I'm not an economist, but if we're gonna just make it up, I say go big or go home. How about a $20 trillion coin? Or maybe just forget about it. Do one of these, "Oh, I was digging through the White House couch cushions and Eisenhower must have left this $100 quillion bill laying around."
And Paul Krugman is saying, "Listen to me. I'm not a crazy person. You know I'm not. I'm telling you this makes sense. And you're telling me that your gut is finding it so hard to comprehend that you are kind of defaulting to what feels true rather than what is true."
The trillion-dollar coin does seem a bit like a gimmick in a world of politics.
That's Sarah Binder. She's the political scientist in our story, a professor at George Washington University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Although we tend to like put policy and policy solutions in one bucket and the politics in a different bucket, that's not how lawmakers see the world.
Binder studies Congress, and she is in this piece because as much as this is a story about the nature of money, money and how government handles it kind of go hand in hand.
Like the politics and the policies, they're tightly intertwined. You can't escape the politics. And so when you're asking them, should we raise the debt limit? To what level? Should we suspend it? Right? Those aren't strictly policy questions, right? They're political problems.
The political problem here isn't that the government can't pay its bills. It's that Republicans in Congress don't want to vote for a debt limit increase so that they can use the threat of default to leverage the Democrats into spending cuts.
And so even if we think that the debt limit is, like, in today's world, almost nonsensical because the money's already out the door, right? Lawmakers see the politics.
The money's already out the door, which kind of turns this into a game of political chicken.
But my sense is at the end of the day, nobody really wants to be blamed. Lawmakers don't want to be blamed for really bad outcomes. And this seems like it could be a really bad financial and political outcome if they don't raise the debt limit.
We don't know exactly what would happen if the government defaults, other than that it would be really, really bad. Millions of jobs lost, global financial catastrophe bad. That's why Congress has raised the debt limit almost 80 times since 1960. But we also don't know what would happen if the Biden administration acted unilaterally, invoked the 14th Amendment that you've heard about the past couple of weeks, the part that says the public debt of the United States as authorized by law shall not be questioned, or if they issued premium bonds, or if they minted a trillion-dollar coin. So look, this is not without controversy. You've spent a very long time, years now, working out the legal framework for this. But it does seem to me that it all kind of comes down to what Janet Yellen and Jay Powell say. No?
So that's a very good question. And the short answer is, I know this is, sounds weird. It is a gimmick, just like the rest of this is a gimmick.
There's uncertainty about all of it.
I don't know as a political scientist, and I don't know whether the economists know this as well yet, but there's at least a lot of uncertainty about how financial markets would react.
The debt limit that needs to be raised is a gimmick. Minting a trillion-dollar coin is a gimmick. How money works is kind of a gimmick.
It's almost like Voltaire said, in a world of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. All we're trying to do here is tell the truth how money works. And apparently that's enough to cause everybody's heads to explode.
It's not that minting a trillion-dollar coin is a good idea or a bad idea. And it's not like invoking the 14th Amendment is a good idea or a bad idea. They're just ideas. But they're on the table because the reality of how money works has been warped by the politics of how money works. We had a lot of material for the show today, a whole lot, which meant that inevitably some of it, most of it, I guess, was going to wind up on the cutting room floor. But there were some things in there that we thought you might be interested in. So here's the question I asked Phil Diehl after I had him read me the 37 words of the Coinage Act that gave the Treasury Secretary the authority to mint platinum coins. Why platinum, by the way?
Well, this was part of my strategy, my longer-term strategy, and that was I wanted to demonstrate that the U.S. Mint was capable of going into international markets, in particular the Japanese market, which is a very significant platinum, international platinum bullion market. And I wanted to demonstrate that I could go in and take that market away from a competitor. And one of the things I said was, I don't want Congress to give me a mandate that I have to produce this coin, which is what every other coin, I think dating back to the founding of the Republic back in 1792, Congress mandated the coins be produced. And I said, I want to have the choice. And so the third word in this language is may. The Secretary may mint, not shall mint. And that reflects the vision of what I wanted to do. Then platinum, we said platinum because the U.S. Mint had never produced a platinum coin before. And so it was a blank slate for us. And I wanted that blank slate.
How did it go in the Japanese market? Did you get it?
Yes. We within 6 to 9 months, we had taken 65% of that market, which was, I mean, that got the attention of the mint community around the world, and it is a pretty tight-knit community. And so, yes, it was very successful. And as a result of that success, we had the credibility we needed to go back to Congress and say, okay, we think we can do the 50 state quarters now. And that program ended up being the most successful collectible of any kind in the history of collectibles.
This final note on the way out today, and I know I said we weren't getting into the actual nuts and bolts of what's going on with the debt limit, but look, we're a news program. We can't help it. Anyway, two things to make sure you know about. Number one, Goldman Sachs was out with a research note the other day that said, based on its calculations, the Treasury Department is going to run short on ready cash on or about the 8th of June. To be clear, that is not run out of money on June the 8th. Because we just spent half an hour talking about that, right? That is the day, June the 8th, that Goldman figures the Treasury's bank balance falls below $30 billion, which is where the department has kind of let people know things start to get really tight in terms of paying the daily bills. Item two, and related, there is a great story in the Washington Post today about the guy in the Treasury Department whose job it is to keep track of how much cash the United States has in its various bank accounts. Read the piece, just trust me. But here are a couple of relevant statistics. Number one, each day on average, $185 billion goes in and out of federal accounts every day. And then every year, the federal government makes about 1.4 billion individual payments. That's everything from Social Security checks to giant military contracts. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. A little debt limit historical irony with which to end the program today. You have probably heard by now, and if not, well, here you go, that we've only had a debt limit since 1917 and the Second Liberty Bond Act of that year, which Congress passed to make it easier for the Treasury Department to borrow money. Look it up. History is cool. Maria Hollenhorst and Richard Cunningham did all the hard work. and produced today's special program. Livy Burdett, Andy Corbin, Nicholas Giong, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry are the rest of the team. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.